This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to The Spectator Podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be looking at the situation with Russia and whether diplomatic relations have been poisoned as a result of the Salisbury attack. We'll also be discussing the bullying scandal in Westminster and considering whether sledging and cricket has gone too far. First up, the nerve agent attack on Sergei Skripal in Salisbury has led to an outbreak of antagonism between Britain and Russia. Theresa May has now expelled a host of Russian diplomats, but can anything be done to stop Putin's assault on Western values? That's the question Owen Matthews asks in the magazine this week, and he joins me now along with Tom Tugendhat, the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. So Owen, you've been out in Moscow. How much coverage has there actually been of the Salisbury attack?
Well, strangely enough, there was a deafening silence the first couple of days, and then they went into very familiar denial mode. Familiar, I mean, from the more or less every moment that Russia's been accused of anything, from the Crimea annexation to the Olympic doping scandal to the US election hacking. Essentially, the coverage of Skripal has been, this is another ridiculous plot to discredit Russia because the West is jealous and fearful of our might. That's been the clear line of all Russian media coverage.
Tom, do you think that the West is quite fearful of Russia's might? It doesn't seem to have responded particularly forcefully to anything that Putin has done over the past few years.
No, I don't think that it's fearful of its might. I think we're concerned that it's so unpredictable because it's such a rogue regime based on a relatively unstable individual who is weak and getting weaker, which is why he's lashing out.
And Owen, how much do you think that the upcoming elections are influencing this?
Well, no, I think Colonel Tugendhat is right, certainly in the sense that what the West fears is not Russia's strength at all, it's Russia's weakness. That's certainly true. I think, personally, the elections really don't have very much to do with this at all, certainly in the sense that Putin certainly has no need of further bolstering or further scandal. And in fact, I suspect the elections, but actually more importantly, the World Cup, which Russia has invested enormous money and diplomatic capital in making a success, is a much more important consideration in Putin's mind. So I think actually, I suspect that the timing of this actually suggests that the people who executed it were operating rather regardless of the Kremlin's true priorities rather than motivated by them.
Tom, do you agree with that, that this isn't actually that helpful to Putin almost?
Well, I think there's no doubt that Putin's going to stuff the ballot boxes, so it's not electioneering in that sense. It's electioneering in a longer term sense, I would argue, where he's playing a strongly nationalist card, as he did with the invasion of Ukraine, with the occupation of Georgia and the annexation of the Crimea. And that's the kind of electioneering it is, not a sort of a short-term phase. And that's why he's trying to paint himself as the enemies of the traitors of Russia, as he puts it, which is ironic, of course, because he's the one who's betrayed Russia for 20 years by stealing off its people and murdering its civic activists.
And in terms of some of the responses that are being considered to the Salisbury attack, Tom, what's more important? Is it further economic sanctions or is it sort of cultural sanctions along the lines of not attending the World Cup?
Well, I think there's a range of sanctions, but the key has got to be to target them because the Russian people who've been oppressed by this dictator for the best part of a generation should not be paying the price for this latest abuse. Who should be paying the price is the new Tsar, Putin, and his acolytes. So what we should be doing is identifying where he's hidden his stolen money. And we know that Putin's stashed hundreds of millions of dollars overseas, including in places like Switzerland and sometimes, sadly, through London in different markets. And so we should be identifying that and freezing his accounts.
Would you describe this as a terrorist act?
It's certainly an act of terror, yes. I mean, that's exactly what it's designed to do. This isn't simply a murder. If Putin had just wanted to murder Mr. Skripal, he would have had him shot or run over or something. This is quite deliberately done so that we should know that it's done by the Russian state. That's why he's using a nerve agent that is not only traceable, but actually has a chemical signature that points it to a single laboratory just outside Moscow and points it to a batch that we know was produced recently.
Owen, one of the arguments that Jeremy Corbyn has been making this week is that we need to beware escalating tensions further. Is that a valid concern given the tensions have been somewhat escalated by the attack itself?
Well, certainly, I don't think there's any British-Russian relations can really go any further down because there have already been, I mean, Britain is already had a disastrous relationship with Russia since 2006, since the Litvinenko murder. I think the problem is, the reality is that actually, though Colonel Tugendhat is completely right that we can sanction the wealth of wealthy Russians, of Putin acolytes even, people who are supposedly close to Putin, but the problem is that what we've seen is that that hasn't really had any effect on his behaviour or on his popularity since those sanctions were first introduced back in 2013. In fact, the first round predates the Crimea annexation. I mean, yes, we can hurt their wallets of wealthy Russians, but again, I don't think Putin really cares. And strangely enough, I think any further economic sanctions can only strengthen him for two reasons. One, we've already discussed, he really believes and presents himself as the leader of a country at war and defending Russia from the attacks, the unjustified calumnies and attacks of the West. So any sanctions actually just strengthen his sense of being in a besieged fortress and buttress his propagandistic image of himself as a sort of defender of the motherland. But also, I think that the problem with further economic sanctions is they tend to target the wrong people. I mean, there are plenty of people who are, you know, by various definitions, sort of close to Putin, because anyone who does business in Russia in a big way is close to Putin, has to be at least not against Putin. But that doesn't mean that Putin himself will be in any way bothered by the failing fortunes of various oligarchs. And in fact, he's himself being very insistent that oligarchs should bring their money back to Russia. So in fact, it rather plays into his own agenda of what he calls de-offshorizing Russian wealth.
Tom?
Of course, that's true, and Ern's absolutely right that his concerns are for no one but himself, which is why I think what we should be doing is going through the accounts that we know of and the assets that we know of and advertising where Putin's own money is. We know, for example, that when his son-in-law divorced his daughter, part of the divorce settlement included $2 billion, which is an awful lot for a man whose only qualification is that he married the president's daughter.
Tom, how do you rate Boris Johnson's handling of this? Theresa May has obviously been leading the response, but Boris Johnson has been making calls to his counterparts, and he was expecting a response from his counterpart in Russia this week.
Well, look, I think it's absolutely essential that the United Kingdom reaches out to its allies. And I have to say, I've been in conversation with my opposite numbers in the Assemblée Nationale in France, in the Bundestag in Germany, and with others around NATO partners and around Europe. And it's quite clear that in parliaments around the world, we enjoy an enormous level of support by people who realise that this is simply another act of Russian aggression in a long pattern, including, as we know, the attempt to destabilise and undermine the elections in France, in Germany, the attempted murder of the Montenegrin Prime Minister. I mean, I can go on. And so we do enjoy an awful lot of support. And I think it's important that the government reaches out to our partners and makes sure that this isn't solely a British action, because although we could act alone, it is, as we all know, much better to act with allies.
And is the Foreign Secretary doing a good job on that front?
The Foreign Secretary, I'm sure, is making his voice heard. As you know, he has an amazing ability to communicate.
Owen, what do you think of the response from the British government?
Well, I think, frankly, unfortunately, I mean, as effective a communicator as Boris Johnson may be, his Achilles heel and the basic problem with the British government's position is the only truly effective economic sanctions that can actually be made against Russia are in concert with Europe. Britain has basically zero balance of trade. We import more or less no Russian gas, or if we do, only through third parties. The only way to really hurt the Russian economy, which is, by the way, very deeply integrated into the European economy, but it's deeply integrated through energy, and that really means energy to Eastern Europe and Germany. So actually, the only real mechanism that Britain has for hurting Russia or for really making Putin stop and think is through Europe, and I fear that's been fundamentally damaged by Brexit. I think clearly it's something that Putin understands, and it's why his propagandists have been so fiercely supportive of Brexit, because he believes that divided Europe will fall, and he's doing everything possible to divide Europe and certainly to encourage every possible form of separatist movement, from Scottish independence to Catalan independence to Brexit. I think that fundamentally the only real action that can be taken long term is to reduce Europe's and particularly Germany's dependence on Russian energy.
Thanks, Owen and Tom. And I'm now joined by Radek Sikorski, former foreign minister of Poland. So Theresa May has said this week that Britain is going to give a robust response to the Salisbury attack, which she has said Russia is responsible for. Do you think that other European countries feel quite so robust in their support for May's response?
Well, the Prime Minister has announced that some spies will be expelled, but she hasn't done what the informal leader of the Russian opposition has asked her to do, Mr. Navalny, which is to target funds stolen from the Russian people and laundered here in London. I think that would be much more effective as a response. It would address the kleptocracy's way of life, which is to steal the money in Russia and then keep it and enjoy it in the West, primarily in London. That's the sort of thing that President Putin would notice.
Do you also think that a cyber attack, which has been mooted in some quarters, would also be an appropriate response?
I would be careful with that, because open societies such as ourselves are always more vulnerable to these techniques. I'm also no great fan of boycotting sports. The Olympic tradition was that you actually suspend wars for the duration of the games. But it's these financial networks of dodgy money that I think would be more effective.
The Russian embassy has threatened retaliation for any response from Britain. Do you think there's a risk that this could escalate and escalate and escalate? Or actually, is it important for Britain to show strength because that's what Putin respects?
Well, Britain expels Russian spies. Russia has to expel yours. The question is which spies were doing more effective spying. And I suspect that, again, the Russians have been able to run more freely of a free society.
Will this response from Britain help other European countries that are closer to the Russian border that are feeling much more vulnerable to aggression from Vladimir Putin?
Well, first of all, I hope the people of Britain notice that European allies have been more forthright in condemning this attack on Britain than some other allies, including the president of the European Council, Donald Tusk, today. But yes, I mean, we've lived with Russia for 500 years. We know a thing or two about how they carry on.
And it's important to you that aggression is met with a show of strength?
Particularly under a leader that sells himself to his people as a macho individual. These kinds of provocations, whether they are in Syria or in London or in Salisbury, are to be expected. Let's remember how President Putin came to power. He came to power because of the blowing up of apartment blocks in Russia with a controlled substance called hexogen and the restart of the Chechnya war. And that sort of thing seems to play well with the Russian public. So I'm afraid it's a structural phenomenon in dealing with that country.
Now, beyond a build-up of NATO troops around the border, can you see any circumstances where there might be a greater military response to some of Russia's actions?
We've, over the last few years, at last, we've built up some symbolic NATO presence in the Baltic states. In Poland, it's insufficient to fight a kinetic war, but hopefully enough for Russia to realize that any Ukraine-style aggression against a NATO member would mean a war with NATO. I hope it's also an argument for everyone, including Britain, to maintain the sanctions that were imposed after Russia grabbed territory by force for the first time since the Second World War by annexing Crimea and sending its irregulars into Donbass. Because I think we need to convince Russia to come back within the fold of international law.
And how do you think Brexit will impact this?
I suspect President Putin is testing Britain partly because of Brexit. I suspect he is thinking that Britain's current account deficit will grow as a result of Brexit, and therefore Britain will be even more hooked on dodgy foreign money, including Russian money, and therefore the response against Russian oligarchs will be as muted as it was after the Litvinenko murder.
And finally, is Jeremy Corbyn's response to this useful for Putin, or does it not really figure?
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I suspect that Mr. Corbyn, who wasn't sound on facing up to the Soviet Union back in the 70s and 80s, cannot be trusted on this one either.
Thanks, Ruddock.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Next, two bullying scandals have descended on Westminster this week, one involving the Speaker, John Bercow, and the other seeing Debbie Abrahams step down from shadowing the DWP brief for Labour. Has Parliament not learned its lesson after the sleaze revelations at the end of last year? Or is the focus on bullying just further evidence of the toxic atmosphere in Parliament? Katie Balls has written for Coffee House about the latest revelations, and she joins me now along with the Financial Times' Laura Hughes. So Laura, where have we got to with the bullying allegations that have started to surface?
Well, obviously we had this review that was carried out by cross-party group of MPs. That was in the wake of all the harassment stories. But obviously, bullying is now the big issue that everybody is talking about. It's taken longer to surface because it's a lot harder to prove. And actually, you've got a lot of men who are being bullied. And again, there's complexity there as to how comfortable they feel coming forward. And Newsnight had this big piece on, you know, allegations made against John Bercow and some other MPs, all of which they've denied. But it's something that when you talk to young researchers, comes up all the time. You know, shouting, things being thrown in the office, ridiculous hours, unfair pay. And again, because there's no HR structure of yet and there is nowhere to complain, it's really difficult. And I'm talking to some people at the moment who have some bullying allegations and they've actually have complained to a party, but those complaints have just gone to the whip. Well, what does that mean for them? There's no sort of formal structure that we are now going to see with the sexual harassment. The new policy does cover bullying, but again, what do you really do to punish bullying? And it's always going to be one person's word against the other, and it's less incidences. It can just be repeated behaviour. But it is coming out, and I think it's really important because actually I think there's probably more bullying, actually, than sexual harassment going on in Parliament.
Katie, some of the allegations about long hours and being shouted at do sound like the sort of old school culture that some MPs would think was entirely acceptable. Is it quite difficult to draw the line in a lot of these cases between just a demanding boss and a bully?
Yeah, I think there is a difficulty. As with any issue, there are different scale here and there's some which are perhaps more serious than other instances. There's also some who would say, if you don't like working late and having a boss who's very, you know, stressy, maybe this isn't the job for you. Parliament is known to be, politics is a stressful career. But I think there's always a line, isn't it? And it's working out when that line is crossed. And what makes this procedure so much more complicated is the fact that there isn't really this independent body. And that means every complaint, if your line manager is the person who is the problem, where do you go after that? And if you go to a party's internal complaints team, no matter, any successful complaint is bad news for the party because it is a complaint about someone who's in that party. So it gets to this very difficult way of doing that. And also, even if you look at Labour alone and this week, the number of internal complaints and inquiries they're having to look at, they would need a very expansive team to be doing that. You've got complaints about complaints. So it gets quite meta.
Yes, Laura, how are the parties handling the complaints internally, aside from the appropriateness of a party marking its own homework to a certain extent? Are inquiries proceeding or are they sort of sinking into a very big in-tray?
There are lots of cases I'm aware of that are still going on months after the complaint was made, and a lot of complainants are confused as to why it's taking so long.
Is that the case in every party?
I think my feeling is that the Conservatives actually deal with things quicker and have been a bit quicker off the mark. Labour have been slower. That's in my experience. You know, I don't know, obviously, of every case, and I can't make that judgment, but this is purely based on the people that I've spoken to. And I've been aware, and I have written about this one instance where a woman complained, and in her formal complaint, she referenced a witness to the alleged incident. That witness was an MP. I spoke to that MP, and he confirmed he'd never been contacted before the party threw out the complaint. And looking at it just as a, you know, not an expert in these sort of trials and proceedings, that just doesn't make sense to me. And it's left a lot of women feeling really confused as to what's going on. And the simple truth is that because suddenly this has opened up, the parties don't have the systems to deal with it. The old system was, you told the whips might bring the MP in and go, look, we've had a few complaints, you need to watch out there. Or they might use it against you when a vote comes up. That, I hope, is not still going on, but some people think it might be. that, you know, complaints are being made, and what's really happening, is it still just being used as ammunition to keep politicians in check and in line? So it's really hard for them to know what to do, but let's be honest, you know, in the 21st century, they should have systems to deal with this. And hopefully the whole purpose of this story was to show, look, it doesn't matter the severity of the complaint, there is a universally inadequate response to it.
Katie, one of the problems, I suppose, is that a lot of MPs haven't actually managed people before they come into Parliament. They're basically operating roughly along the lines of small businesses, albeit funded by IPSA. Do you think that MPs, alongside the anti-sexual harassment training that they're going to receive as a result of the cross-party work, that they should also receive training on, I suppose, how not to bully, but also how to manage people effectively? Because it is difficult and some people don't take to it naturally.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that should be looked at. But I also remember, I think it was Jeremy Corbyn who at one point suggested maybe in the wake of the Westminster sleaze, MPs could have training. And everyone laughed at this idea and thought it was perhaps a bit patronising. And actually, that's part of the problem too. It's addressing the fact that things that perhaps should seem easy aren't always easy. People come in, some from, you know, long business careers, some people come in from a special advisor job, but everyone has such a difference of experience. I also think not every MP is going to be a great people manager, but therefore, if that is the case, then you just need to hire the next one down to them, someone in the staff who is able to. So I think you have to be a bit realistic about everyone's strengths here, but I think a basic training could be useful, but also just a basic code of conduct. I think often it's not clear what the expectation is, which means that you don't really know if someone is behaving above or below. And it's the same when you look at what should or shouldn't be expected as of an employee. I think you actually, if you just had clarity on these things, it would make it a lot easier to work out when things go tipped to the balance of being too far.
What do you think of the way Andrea Leadsom has been handling all of this? Because her job as leader of the House looked a bit like a sort of a demotion, trying to get her into a quieter role. And she's had to take on not just a sexual harassment scandal, but a sort of ballooning portfolio with the bullying as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go with the theory that Number 10 don't like Andrea Leadsom having that much attention on her, particularly media attention, then I don't think they quite envisage her brief being what it is now. I think she is stepping up to the plate in many ways. I think Andrea Leadsom, particularly since that leadership election, is quite a divisive figure in Parliament with those comments on motherhood. But actually, a lot of people who don't really rate her politics, perhaps, I think have spoken, I've found quite warmly about what she is doing now. I think the problem is with these cross-party consensus though in these reports, they do seem to be able to agree on some things, but you're not quite sure still where it's actually going. So you have the Westminster sleaze that they all met after that, and everyone's agreed there should be this type of independent body, and everyone's agreed there should be these clear messages, and for a while everyone agreed that sports and social was bad, which is the bar in Parliament everyone can go to, and there seem to be the right noises coming from that side, but I think it's still not clear either when I speak to staffers if things are going to look different in 2 months' time.
Yes, Laura, when will things look different?
Well, MPs and peers still need to vote on the recommendations, and then it's got to come in, and then it will be enacted, and they'll review it after 6 months. You know, part of it, and part of the reason it's been set up, is also to act as a deterrent. You know, if you're an MP and you know that there is somewhere independent that you can go to, that should stop you from acting the way that perhaps you might have done in the past. It's a real test as to whether or not people trust it. The reason they don't trust it at the moment is because if you make a complaint to the Labour Party, your name will be seen by members of the NEC, NCC, etc. So you don't want to make that complaint. This controversially keeps everybody anonymous right until the end when they've made their decision on the MP. So perhaps people come forward. You might see it just being used for HR support. So you might have someone going to an independent person and saying, look, is this reasonable? And they'll go, actually, nope, that violates your contract, or, oh, your contract doesn't look right. And then you can go back and you've got the kind of support from people that know what they're talking about who aren't connected to the party. So I think on that level will help. How many more people come forward? I don't know, because all the reasons why they don't now are still going to be there, but potentially because it's independent, they might do more. And with it, obviously, yeah, there should be a clear boundaries of what is acceptable and not. The interesting thing is I spoke to a former whip who said that she'd often speak to MPs and give them a ticking off, and their response would be, oh, I thought I was just being nice. I thought I was just being friendly. And there genuinely is sometimes just a complete difference in attitude, because that's the way it was. You know, it was absolutely fine to slap your secretary on the bum when she walked past and she wouldn't have complained. I think things have shifted. So having this all there, I hope, does act as a deterrent. I think it was the reason for all these stories, and it's the reason why all these MPs have had to go through all of this in the public, you know, domain. It's a test of what happens. And there are, I think Andrea Leadsom gets it. And she gets there are two loopholes in their report. You know, it's amazing that they all agreed on it, but there is still no provision for third-party reporting, for witnesses of incidents to come forward. And there's also still a question of what happens if an MP gropes a young woman in a nightclub in his constituency and she has nothing to do with the political party. Is that considered part of his private life? That was the problem with the old code of conduct. So there are still holes in this. It's more complicated. When you actually look at cases, it's not black and white.
Thank you, Katie and Laura. And finally, sledging, the subtle art of putting your opponent off their game, has long been a part of cricket. But in the magazine this week, Simon Barnes asks whether recent developments show things have gone too far. To discuss, I'm joined by Charlie Campbell, captain of the Authors 11 and author of Herding Cats, and cricket fanatic James Forsyth. So Charlie, in his magazine piece this week, Simon Barnes is saying that sledging is hot again. Why is that?
This is the South Africa-Australia series where David Warner has taken great umbrage in some of the remarks allegedly made by the South African players, which are pointing at his private life, particularly his wife. And Warner, who is no paragon of virtue in cricket, is the player who's suddenly saying there's a line, enough is enough, you've crossed the line.
James, are you a fan of sledging?
I think most sledging is inane. I think there's occasionally very clever bits of sledging. I remember when Andrew Flintoff was standing at slip two and Tino Best, who's a West Indian tail-end batsman, was batting. He, slow bowler, was bowling for England and he said, "Mind the windows, Tino." Tino Best took the bait, charged down the wicket, tried to hit the ball out of the ground, and ended up, I can't remember if he was being bowled or stumped. That's a clever bit of sledging. I think most of the "you're effing shit" stuff doesn't really work. But there's also another thing, which is people know certain weaknesses of certain players. And I think moving the fielders into those positions is actually plays with the batsman's mind much more than chirping at him.
But it is supposed to be psychological warfare, isn't it, Charlie? Does it have that effect?
It can do. My team, I play for a team of writers, and they're perfectly capable of disintegrating mentally without any help from the opposition. I would also say that Tino Best probably would have got out anyway.
Yes. I don't think Andrew Flintoff saved the match by that.
No, I mean, Tino West is definitely one of life's number 11s. But it is trying to make the opposition mentally disintegrate, and just occasionally that can work.
Is it something that the umpire can intervene on?
Yes, although you would look really to the captains to police their own team. And the problem is that David Warner, who is slightly ironically known as the Reverend because of his very, very checkered past and supposedly this new leaf he's turned over, but he's vice-captain of the Australian team. So he leads by example, and sledging is something really that has taken root in Australian cricket far more than anywhere else, and they are the best at it.
I think there's an interesting issue here because lots of people thought that sledging was going to die out, or the competitive edge was going to come out of international cricket because of these 2020 franchise leagues, which means that lots of people playing in these test matches have now been teammates together in the IPL or one of these other big buck 2020 leagues around the world. I think this shows that it's not going to go, and that weirdly enough, if there's a kind of positive to take from this, it is that test cricket, international cricket, remains the pinnacle. People are perfectly prepared to have a pop at people, even if it's going to make sharing a dressing room for Kolkata Knight Riders more difficult in the future. I think that is quite an interesting aspect of this. I also think there's a question about this Australian team, which is, you know, the Ashes series between England and Australia. England obviously got absolutely walloped, and I think they've got walloped regardless whether Australia had sledged them or not. But the fact that got so testy is, I think there is a feeling among lots of other sides in the international cricketing circuit at the moment that this Australian side dish it out, so they should be able to take it.
Charlie, is it the case that actually good quality sledging should be part of the cricketing culture? I mean, cricket is in the sort of wider culture of cricket, it is a game about words. That's why Test Match Special is so popular. That's why The Wit of Cricket is such a popular programme.
Well, in the, you know, 100 plus years of Test cricket, there really are remarkably few one-liners that have stayed with us. And we all know the famous ones. There was a lovely one I was told recently of Viv Richards, hitting Johnny Barclay, the very affable former Sussex captain, for consecutive sixes. And Johnny was standing there looking rather forlorn, and Viv came up to him and said, "Don't worry, Johnny, if it weren't bowlers like you, there wouldn't be great batsmen like me."
Is it supposed to be heard, the sledging, by those watching? So no. The Mind Them Windows, Tino, is particularly famous because it was picked up by the microphones, and you can watch the clip. It's very funny on YouTube, but most of it goes under the radar, doesn't it?
No, and I think this is one of these kind of tensions. Lots of players are unhappy about the fact that this stuff is now heard, and because of these stump microphones, there is far more controversy about sledging than there used to be. I think there's also, when you talk to current cricketers or former cricketers, they have, and interestingly, they seem to have a pretty certain ideas of who they think is unacceptable, who takes it too far. Mm-hmm. So within their world, there does appear to be some kind of code and a view taken on who it is. I haven't spoken to anyone about this incident, but knowing what certain people in the world of cricket think about David Warner, I will be surprised if there is a mass outpouring of sympathy for him.
But jokes about people's wives are also, firstly, not particularly funny, and they don't really fit into the sort of play up and play the game spirit, do they, Charlie?
No, I mean, if David Warner had said, if he'd taken the "this is just naked misogyny" from the South Africa team, again, it would have been quite surprising from him, but it would have been much more easily applauded. Going back to the stump microphone things, the players have a very interesting way of getting them switched off, which is they mutter names of companies, rivals, to the sponsors in a bid to get them switched off, because you don't want rival companies being broadcast on air.
That's fabulous. And in your cricket team, what are the best sledges that you have produced or been subject to, Charlie?
Well, early on in our game, in our season, we went up to a pitch in Yorkshire playing against Harold Larwood's old team, and they were saying they might all be able to spell, but they can't play cricket. We haven't really needed sledging to lose. We've tended to do it on our own, and normally teammates are wittiest and most vicious about each other. As the season goes on, cricket, you spend more time with each other than any other sport, really. So the conversation gets sharper and sharper. I've been sledged by a Church of England priest.
What sort of sledging?
Obscene. But you set yourself up to it. You know, when you walk out to bat, anything about you can be picked at. A friend of mine telling me about his own team, and someone walked out in a jumper denoting a Cambridge blue, and he played and missed at his first ball. And, well, the wicketkeeper said, "Is that a blue you've got there?" And he said, "Yes." And he played and missed at his first ball. And then the wicketkeeper said, "What sport?"
Thanks, Charlie and James. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including the Spectator Books podcast, where this week Sam Leith talks to Tom Wright about St. Paul. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on the podcast, as well as great pieces by Matthew Paris, Paul Staines, and an interview with Steve Bannon. We also have a special offer, 3 months as a Spectator in print and online for just £12, and we'll even throw in a free ticket to see Rod Liddell live at the London Palladium on May the 15th. Tickets to that are normally £40, so you'd be a fool to miss out. Just go to spectator.co.uk/Liddell. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.